Feliciano versus American West, 56012. We'll take a second, get parties set up for this argument. Again, if counsel is doing the argument, if you'll state your name for the record and for the movement, please let us know how much time you wish to reserve for rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Craig Fuller, and I am the attorney for the homeowners on this particular case. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes to rebut. In this case, may it please the Court, this case is about four main issues. There are four main issues that we need to address with the Court, and I know my time is limited. The four main issues are the application of 11220, NRS 11220, in the construction defect scheme. The second issue we need to address is what is the application of the savings clause contained in 11.203, 204, 205? What is the application of 11.202 and whether it's an abuse of discretion of the court to not award discovery time when it is alleged and what must be alleged? And lastly, of course, the fourth issue is whether a subsequent purchaser or a subsequent owner should be required to file a Chapter 40 notice and start a new claim. I must say at the outset, with time limited, I would like to thank the Nevada Justice Association for the amicus brief. I think they covered this beautifully. If I don't get to that issue, I would cite the court to that amicus brief and say that covers that issue quite well. Starting with 11220, I think this is a case of first impression. I really do. If we look at all the cases that have discussed 11220 in the construction defect area, there is really no case that discusses whether 11220 is to be applied at the same time 11203, 204, and 205 are applied in the current statutory scheme. And that's, in fact, what the trial court did in this particular case. In this case, the trial court said the statute giving 4 years applies once a plaintiff or a homeowner notices something in their house that would give them some reasonable notice that they should investigate whether that's a defect. Now, remember, Your Honor, this is a motion for summary judgment. So the trial court needs to be looking to see if there is any material fact that should be going to the jury. And in this particular case, what the trial court did was say, well, 11220 does apply, and it used a case that this court decided back in 1971 called Hartford versus Statewide Plumbing, I believe. Statewide Appliances, I'm sorry. And what the court said was that case specifically allows the trial courts to apply 11220 in a construction defect case. That's not what the holding of Hartford is. The Hartford case is a tortious injury to real property after the explosion of a water heater that had happened.
Mr. Fuller, let me ask you, because I know we got a lot of issues and a lot of stat. Let's say for the sake of argument, we agreed with you on 11220. What about 11203 in the 10 years and the fact that it appears that the notice was filed after the 10 years expired and the operation of the savings clause and all?
Thank you, Justice Gibbons. I appreciate you pointing me to that. 11203, 204, 205 contain a savings clause. And in those particular statutes, the legislature was very clear with its language. And there are a lot of cases cited here in the briefs, and this court has cited it many times, that if a statute is clear and unambiguous on its face, it must be given its plain meaning. And this statute says, if an injury occurs in the 10th year. It doesn't say if an injury first occurs in the 10th year. It does not say if the homeowner notices for the first time an injury in the 10th year. And I think the legislature wrote that because it's common sense. Many times an injury will occur in the 10th year to the building envelope, but it won't manifest itself until the 11th year or 12th year. So how does the homeowner know if it occurred in the 10th year or not until it's the homeowner sees something?
That's not the case, at least in the Feliciano matter. That was, they noticed damage long before.
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. In certain instances, but our expert, which was, by the way, unrebutted, there was no rebuttal to our expert report in the motion for summary judgment, said, I identified over 100 defects. The court focused on about 7 in each of these cases. Some had a little few more, some had a few less. But yes, absolutely, it did. Answering Justice Gibbons' question about why should that, why should the homeowner be allowed to bring his claim if you bring it in the 11th year or 12th year? The legislature was pretty clear. If the injury occurs in the 10th year, how are they going to know it occurred in the 10th year if it doesn't manifest in the, until the 11th year?
Specifically talking about the rain, you're indicating each time it rains it has a separate, distinct injury occurs as opposed to an injury in the sense of the building envelope is defective.
Yes, Your Honor, that is what the expert put his, that was the declaration by our expert, and I would submit to the court that in and of itself is a matter of material fact for a jury to decide. Did injury occur in the 10th year? That was evidence that was put before the trial court, and the trial court on its own decided, well, that's an ongoing injury that probably has been happening over a number of years, so that doesn't qualify under the statute because it needs to be a first occurrence of the injury.
But did he indicate as part of his opinion to support his position that each time it rained a separate and distinct injury occurred?
The declaration by the expert, Ron Russo, specifically stated that every time any water enters the building envelope, it causes further deterioration to the structures in that home, in the building envelope, to the underlayment, to the...
Isn't that a little speculative?
Isn't that a question of fact for the jury to decide? Maybe it is, maybe it's not. It's up to the plaintiffs to prove that, but it is not up to the trial court to take that away from the plaintiffs to prove whether that occurred or not. I think it's a matter of...
The trial court make credibility determinations. Is that not appropriate in a summary judgment?
Not appropriate on a summary judgment motion. This is a summary judgment motion. If there is any material fact, a scintilla of material fact, it's got to go to the jury. And in this particular case, remember, we were 3 months into discovery when the summary judgment motion was filed on these four homes.
Can the judge make the determination that that's speculative and non-material, therefore?
I don't believe in a summary judgment that a judge can.
Well, now be careful, because that's part of the judge's duty is to make a determination as materiality.
I agree that it should be. But in a case like this, where it was an unopposed opinion by an expert that said, my opinion is injury occurred on this date because of these reasons, that is sufficient amount of facts for a trier of fact to determine either it did or it didn't. And by the way, I think what she determined, that whether it was the first occurrence of injury or not, and whether the homeowner noticed it for the first time or not, those are material facts that a trier of fact must decide. So the court actually stepped in the role of the jury in this particular case and said, well, I'm going to determine, not based on the statute, because she went beyond the statute. The statutes don't say that it must be the first occurrence, and the statutes don't say that you must first notice it. I mean, if you think about it logically, I believe, it makes sense, because think about a homeowner who comes home the day after the 10th year and has been on vacation in Hawaii and discovers some manifestation in his home that he's never seen before. It's now up to him to prove that that occurred the day before, the week before, and he gets the extra 2 years. But if you go with what the trial court says, then you say, wait a minute, you didn't notice anything in the 10th year, so you don't get the 11th and 12th year. And I think the legislature was very, very clear. The reason they extended it is so that any manifestations of constructional defects that appear in the 11th and 12th year, however you discover them, you have time to prove that those are constructional defects. That's exactly what I think the statute was. And again, when a statute is clear and unambiguous on its face, it must be given its plain meaning. I'd like to move quickly. I have Well, I have a few minutes.
If you could talk about the 11202, the willful misconduct, my question would be, is even under the Tahoe case or the Acosta case, assuming we went in that direction, how would these types of injuries that have been sustained qualify as willful misconduct when you have a home builder, America West, I assume built thousands of homes probably in Clark County? I'm finding the nexus, knowing the basis of these defects, how that could possibly be willful.
I think what the main part of this argument is, number one, is that the defects were alleged by the expert as defects due to building code violations. This is a professional builder. They're charged with the knowledge of knowing what building codes are supposed to be followed, and when they fail to follow them, if they intentionally did it for cost-cutting purposes, for whatever reason, that can be willful misconduct. In this particular case, the plaintiffs alleged enough such that the inference should have gone to the non-moving party. In this case, it's hard to imagine how the trial court gave any inference to the non-moving party. In fact, they gave it to the moving party by saying the circumstantial evidence of the building code violations, that's not enough, that's just negligence. But we made it.
And that's the question, that the building code violation doesn't indicate whether it was willful or negligence. Is that not correct?
It does not indicate it.
Why should we deviate from Tahoe Village?
Well, I think in this particular case, particularly, the defendants asked for time under 56F. We were 3 months into discovery, and the cases, particularly Harrison versus Falcon and other cases, have clearly stated it is an abuse of discretion for the trial.
Is this continued once for additional discovery on a summary judgment motion?
No. I believe what the long delay was, this was like a case where you had 23 homes originally alleged, 19 of them settled. So the first year that was going on was the defendants offered offers of judgment.
I'm just thinking, I seem to recall that it was there was a summary judgment motion earlier, and the judge denied that motion based upon allowing additional discovery.
And it was about a two-year window that this list of alleged defects were known and no discovery was, so to speak, pursued.
What happened was in that first two-year window, 19 of these homes accepted offers of judgment. Then there was a great deal of pleading and litigating over how to get those settlements on, attorney's fees. We went through several motions of what the court should or should not award, and then ultimately we got down to these four were left. This one, the CMO came out.
The request for additional time for discovery, was that made orally? Was it made on motion in written form? And if in written form, did you specifically tell the court what you'd hope to find if you were given additional time?
It was done in the motion for summary judgment. We made a 56F motion. The declaration from our expert, Ron Risto, requested additional time to find out what the defendants want and for us to have time to go and investigate from the defendants exactly what they knew and why they violated these building codes, some of which were life safety issues, according to our experts. So I know I don't want to take up all of my time, but those are very important issues, and I think it is an abuse of discretion 3 months into discovery into these homes to not allow the plaintiffs to conduct their discovery.
Any other questions at this time in terms of...
Thank you.
We'll give you 3 minutes on the back.
Thank you.
Mr. Fiorio.
Mr. Farr, I know you had a lot of issues here. Maybe you could start with this 56F request, and would have been abuse of discretion for the court not to have granted them some additional time to do discovery.
Thank you, ma'am. Please support Mark Farr from American West. I'd be happy to address that, Justice Gibbons. I think you have to put this case in perspective, and I just briefly want to do that, and then I'm going to get right to that issue. What you have here is something that's really almost unprecedented. You had the plaintiffs filing a Chapter 40 notice after the 10-year period had run. Okay, so that's important to know. Then, after that period had run, after they had no evidence of an injury occurring in the 10th year, they brought on an expert who went into two of the four homes after the expiration of the 10-year period. He goes into the home on the 11th year. Okay? He then looks back and speculates, and I agree with you, Justice Barrett, if you look at his affidavit, it is nothing but speculation. He speculates that there could have been an injury in the 10th year, and I'll get to that. Now, why is this 56F issue, in my opinion, a false issue? I'll tell you why. Because the willful misconduct claim to which their 56F request went should never have been brought on those facts. He had no evidence, none, to support a claim against American West for willful misconduct under our current case law. Nothing. And if he had even a scintilla of evidence, he would have presented that at the trial court level, and then we would have had a different inquiry. What he did was he filed a claim against American West based solely on the speculation that there might have been a breach of the building code, with no evidence whatsoever to support a claim of willful misconduct. He violated Rule 11A, and there's considerable debate now going on in the lower court level, and it's probably going to get to you at some point in time, as to how much do we import the Iqbal Twombly standards from the federal court into our state court pleadings. But if you look at the Iqbal Twombly standards, he doesn't even come close to meeting that. And you know, as well as I do, our rules are based on the federal court rules. So the 56F request was nothing but a red herring and nothing but a salvage operation by him at the end of this claim to try to salvage and create an issue when it was a false issue to begin with, because the claim should have never...
Wasn't there an indication also that they hadn't had an opportunity to take the depositions of the principals?
And that...
And therefore, they said that that would have given us what we need to support this claim.
That, again, we were precluded. He had every opportunity to do that. We made no bones about what we were doing on this case in the lower court, okay? The case started as a class action shotgun pleading. There was this offer of judgment process. It got narrowed down to four claims. We went and took the depositions of the four principals, and you see that in the record. So there was plenty of time to do that. A lot of time had elapsed. They made no effort whatsoever to take a deposition, even though they were permitted to do so during that period of time. So the reason the record is the way it is not through any fault of American West. It's not through the judge imposing draconian rules or guidelines. It's because they did nothing. Which gets us back to what this case is all about. This case isn't about a homeowner coming home from Hawaii and seeing something manifest itself in the 10th year. He's arguing a case that's not before you. This case is about homeowners who saw things. If you want me to address the four, and I can reconcile the four-year statute and the statute of repose, but you guys have already done that in other cases.
So go ahead.
It's a simple issue. If you're a homeowner and you come home from Hawaii and you see water stains on your roof, I think you better do something. That's what the law says. We do not encourage people to sit on their rights and do nothing and wait to 10 years or 12 years or 11 and a half years and go get an expert to speculate as to what might happen. That runs afoul of everything that we teach in terms of statute of limitations. You want people to take action appropriately. And then let's look at the interplay between statutes of limitation and statutes of repose. This court has said, and the legislature has said this as well, statutes of repose are actually to benefit people like my client. It's to put an outer limit on their exposure. Statutes of limitation encourage people to bring claims timely so that we can have them brought promptly to the court when the evidence is fresh, when people can remember what they're doing. And remember, the rules you lay down here with regard to statute of limitation should apply across the board. Think about the rule they want you to proffer here. And it really, their argument stems from a misconstruction of Judge Johnson's order. Judge Johnson issued a very lengthy order. I have it here. What Judge Johnson said was, on those issues which you testified under oath, Mr. Homeowner, you knew about in year one, in year two, in year three, in year four. 4 years has passed. You should have promptly vindicated your rights. You didn't do that. She didn't say they were out of the box for everything, which is the construction they're putting on this and what the Nevada Justice Association said. Read her order. She didn't say that. She said if you found something after the four-year period, then another four-year period runs. So this draconian result that they're proffering doesn't exist in her order. She was very careful on that. So what you have is a situation where if a homeowner comes in and sees from Hawaii that the roof is about to cave in, then you got 4 years to bring your claim. You can't sit back and do nothing. That's the principle behind statute of limitation. Those are the principles that this court has addressed in prior cases. There's nothing inconsistent about imposing a statute of limitation on a claim and then dealing also with the statute of repose, which is an outer limit protection for people such as my client. So those arguments are red herring arguments. So to get back to this, what are we talking about? And I really did appreciate the questions that you asked, Justice Perry, regarding the expert's affidavit, because I've dealt with this issue a number of occasions in the lower court, and it's the gatekeeper function as I talk about it. Judges do have an important role when they're considering evidence. You don't just sit back and let anything come in, and you all know that because you've been trial court judges, so you understand the gatekeeper role. If you look at the evidence that they're talking about, and I was interested to see kind of how he shifted during his argument, but the evidence that they're relying on is this expert report from Mr. Risto, and I hesitate to call it an expert report because from my perspective it was nothing more than speculation, as you said. What he says is that you had some problems with the roof, with the envelope, and based upon that, any time it rained in Las Vegas, you had some injury manifest itself. I defy you to look at his report and see where this expert said to a reasonable degree of certainty, given the credentials that he supposedly has, that says on this day within the 10th year, okay, there was a rainstorm that impacted that house and caused that injury. You will not find that anywhere in that report. And I submit to you that is the minimum threshold that would be required to trigger the savings clause under NRS 11203, 204, and 205.
Well, he did say that any rain would cause an injury to the further injury to the building envelope. Good. And then he pointed to three times that it rained in Las Vegas.
And how much, I mean, we've all lived in Las Vegas. It can rain in Summerlin and not rain in Green Valley. It can rain in McCarran and not rain in Summerlin. The issue here isn't whether it rained in Las Vegas. The issue is whether it impacted these houses. That's the key issue. Where is any evidence that this expert interviewed those homeowners and said, on this day when it rained in Las Vegas, did the rain hit your house? Was it a quarter of inch of rain that would have been absorbed by the roof tiles, or was it a torrential downpour? Was it one of our short duration storms where you could flood in an area and not have any rain anywhere else? Was it something that impacted the base of the home as opposed to the roof? Where is any of those types of things? Judge Johnston properly ignored this speculative evidence that they put on. And as the gatekeeper, she considered this and saw it for what it was, a desperate attempt to manufacture a claim to try to fall within the savings clause. And now I want to get to that because that's an important issue here.
Would you also comment a little bit about the willful misconduct and whether or not the Tahoe standard is sufficient, or whether we should look at the ACASA standard, or it doesn't matter?
Well, I think in this case it doesn't matter because I don't think they had any evidence at all, but I think the ruling that you set down in the Tahoe case, it requires something more. You have to knowingly do something to cause harm. Otherwise, it's a meaningless standard. It just blurs with everything else. So I think that really is one of the easier issues for you to address here. But on the savings clause, I want to get to that. Because all of us here, I think, are old enough to remember the MGM case and when our Supreme Court declared the statute to repose unconstitutional.
This is very
he reminds us all the time.
He's still in high school. Really.
All right. Well, the court declared it unconstitutional. Our legislature went back and revised the scheme, and you've seen the legislative history that we proffered. And the purpose behind the savings clause is to protect the individual or the claimant who comes in, and like he says, it's the tenth year. I come in, my roof caves in. I've got 2 days to vindicate my rights, and the legislature properly recognized it. In that context, you know what? We're going to give you an additional 2 years. That's the savings clause. If you interpret it the way they want you to interpret it, you have to take the word savings clause out and then call it an extension clause, because then there is no savings. It just becomes simply a 12-year statute if you follow their argument. And so then that gets back to a rule of statutory construction where you don't render a provision nugatory. You don't rewrite the legislation. So I respect the fact that they are desperately trying to hang on to the occur thing, but I don't think the legislature contemplated that somebody would file a claim after the expiration of 10 years, then go get an expert to speculate that perhaps an injury occurred in the 10th year, and then have that be salvaged for purposes of bringing a claim. Which brings up another important issue, and he shifts back and forth, if you listen to him carefully, between defect and injury, because you asked the question about injury, which is in the statute. Okay? So let's think about if you were to follow their rationale, which we think you should not, then what are they entitled to recover for? It's that injury that occurred in the 10th year. What they're not telling you and what they really want to do is if you believe this speculative expert that he came in the 11th year and he looked back and he found that there was a drop of water that hit a stud from a rainstorm that we don't know if even impacted the house. What they want to say then is that drop of water hitting that stud, which in their mind causes injury, what that does is that opens up my client to a suit for defects from day one through the time they filed suit. That's what they want to do, and that can't be done. The most that this court can do, and I submit you don't need to go there, is if there is an injury that occurs in the 10th year, and they can identify that injury, in this case, the speculative drop of water on a stud or the speculative drop of water on a piece of drywall, they get recovery for that injury. They don't get recovery for the defect itself or any other damage that might have occurred that has been time barred. And that's what they're not telling you. And you've got to be very careful when you shift between defect and injury on that argument. So what are we left with then? From our perspective, we're not left with something that's confusing here. Everybody knows what a statute of limitation is. Judge Johnson surely did, and she had a very well-reasoned and considered opinion on that. Everybody understands statutes of repose. When you look at the legislative history, there is no dispute as to what a savings clause should be. It's for that unforeseen, unfortunate thing that occurs at the end of that time period, and they're going to give you 2 years to bring that claim.
What evidence was developed that there were any building code violations here in these homes?
There was no evidence developed, and that's a very good question, Justice Gibbons. No evidence developed before they filed their claim. Matter of fact, what's interesting to me, and what is particularly galling about this case, is these experts never went into these homes prior to the expiration of the 10-year period of time. We went back and we took the homeowner's depositions. This isn't a situation where you had some poor suffering homeowner who was living in squalor and didn't like their house. They had not even attempted to vindicate their rights. This was an attorney-driven lawsuit, plain and simple. And the expert doesn't even go into the home and look at the home until after the expiration of the 10-year period. That's what you had here. So in our opinion, it was a manufactured case. Judge Johnston saw through that, okay? And the thing that was particularly interesting about this case is rather than, because a lot of these, they talk about the expert and they talk about the vague recollections of the homeowners. How can they denigrate their own client? We went to the people that lived in the house. We deposed the people that lived in the house. We asked them the questions about their own home. That's what we based our motion on. Not the speculative ramblings of an expert who comes in the house at the expiration of after 10 years runs. So when you step back from this, you have really, in my opinion, an unprecedented situation that Judge Johnston dealt with quite appropriately. She gave them the benefit of the doubt. She allowed them an opportunity to make their claims and come in and supplement the record with their expert report. But at the end of the day, she saw through it and she said, "You don't measure up." And there's nothing wrong with her opinion. It was well considered. She properly reconciled statutes of limitation and statutes of repose. And as you correctly pointed out, Justice Paragary, she did her role as the judge and the gatekeeper and saw through that. So with that, we think that her decision should be upheld. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. You have 3 minutes, Counselor.
Thank you, Your Honor. Tough to follow. That was very passionate. I commend Counsel. With regard to one thing that Counsel just raised,
with regard to the injury and whether this court should interpret it as occurring and raising an issue on all issues in the air. That's not before the court today, so I don't think it needs to be addressed. I would like to return to this issue because it seems to be the main issue in the court's focus today on the savings clause of 10 and 12 year. Again, I go back to the legislative intent. The legislature clearly set out a statute for us to follow. Judge Johnson added requirements that are not in the statute to do away with this claim on a motion for summary judgment. And that things that she added into the statute that are not there are that injury must first be discovered in the 10th year, and then it cannot be an injury that is an ongoing injury. Those are not things that are in the statute. The statute is clear and unambiguous on its face, and it must be given its plain meaning, which means if a homeowner can prove at trial that an injury occurred in the 10th year, that claim gets 2 more years to file, to bring his claim in those 2 years. Now, Mr. Ferrario very passionately gave a very nice discussion as to why you shouldn't allow people to find the claims in the 11th year, and particularly shouldn't be able to find injuries in the 11th year or 12th year by using an expert. But we're talking about homeowners. They're lay people. They're lay witnesses. They don't know a defect from an injury from a water stain and what it is. They certainly aren't going to know.
What particular injury, though, did the expert point to?
The expert,
and that's what's baffling to me. There was no definition of what an injury is. So do these judges automatically have to adopt the definition given by an expert in a case?
Do they have to
give a personal determination of what constitutes an injury?
I think on an expert opinion, that is the purview for the trier of fact, absolutely.
What did he, again, point to other than amorphous injury to the structure, the building envelope?
If you look at the expert's declaration that was filed in opposition to the motion for summary judgment, he speaks about what happens when the water enters the building envelope and how it causes deterioration.
But he's speaking in general terms, not specific to this home.
He laid out for each and every home, and although he didn't break it up home by home, he laid out each day that water, in his opinion, taken from not just Las Vegas, the area in Las Vegas, and he cites in there where he found his data, he said, it rained in this area in Las Vegas. He said it
was that it rained in Las Vegas, and he pointed to 3 separate occasions in 2007. The amounts of rain varied between absolutely
minimal and half an inch.
That's why I'm lost. I don't see where he's pointed to a particular injury that's specific to these problems.
Again, what he said was that when the water enters the building envelope, it caused deterioration of the structure.
Now, see, and the way he couches that is very general to me. He didn't say when the water entered the building envelope in this case, in this home, this is what it did to this home. It indicates something very general.
It certainly can be seen as something general. It is. Now, the expert at trial, although which was attached, the expert in the pleadings and the briefs, we attached all the defects, over 100 that he claimed, and those were all what this declaration supported. So this expert did go into homes in that same development and say, these are the defects, and when water enters, these are the defects that are occurring. Now, not each and every one of them by that. And you're right, that declaration probably could have been tightened up. But on a summary judgment motion standard, that is sufficient such that it raises a tribal issue of fact that absolutely the defendants would be entitled to cross-examine the expert on and say, prove to us that this occurred in the 10th year. This is a motion for summary judgment. Inferences must be given to the non-moving party, and they must be given the opportunity to have a jury decide the facts. The court stepped in the role of the jury on this case, and that is exactly why this case is here today. If the trier of fact was able to hear from the expert, the trier of fact could determine, no, I don't think that you have enough evidence to prove that injury occurred on that day. Okay, right out of the box. Thank you. But it is absolutely not appropriate on a summary judgment motion for the court to take on that role, particularly in view in the statute, what the statute says. And the statute says you just have to allege injury occurred. So what the trial court actually did here was the trial court made determinations and almost said, well, particularly with not just this issue, the pleading, misconduct issue, you have to go beyond the pleading stages. You have to sort of give us proof at the pleading stage. And if we don't have proof at the pleading stage, we're not going to let you move forward with the case. And that is the role of the trier of fact. That is not the role of the trial court. And that's where I think the trial court abused its discretion on this particular issue.
Can I ask one more question?
Go ahead.
Mr. Faro said as far as the 56F issue that there was ample time to do discovery, that they did the depositions of the homeowners and all that. And I realize you had these offers of judgment going back and forth and that, and I understand the practicality of it, but why didn't you have sufficient time to depose the principals of America West or the employees or everyone to depose?
This case actually never gone on a discovery track. The CMO wasn't even put into place until July 29, 2009, 3 months before this motion for summary judgment. What happened was there were 23 of these homes in this case that we pretty much settled the whole case. Then all of a sudden, after all the fighting and wrangling went on, it was determined these four could not be settled. One of them, of course, because there was a transfer and there was an issue as to whether they're...
When were these depositions taken of these four homeowners that are the appellants in this case?
Shortly before the summary judgment motions. So, you know, I'm sorry I don't have the dates.
It was close to that. And
it was during that year where we settled the case and after we got all the wranglings and then they took the depositions of these homeowners.
Now, on the CMO, was there a special master appointed on this case?
Floyd Hill was finally appointed.
Okay.
And that's when it was determined we're going to have to go forward on these cases. We got a special master on the case so that we could proceed as a normal construction defect case. July 29th, that CMO was entered and filed. And on 11-13-09, just 3 months later, MSJ was filed.
Okay, and did you let Mr. Hale know you wanted to depose these people and all that?
He knew it was part of the case, absolutely. I'm not sure that we specifically told him what we were going to do, but that was certainly our plan all along. It's always been our plan in these cases. That's what we do to try and determine if, in fact, we can prove at trial, oh, there's a misconduct case. And you know what? If we can't, we drop the claim. But we have to allege it, we have to plead it, and we have to investigate it. And there is enough evidence from this expert to say, you're entitled to do that, and it's an abuse of discretion not to let the plaintiffs at least find out.
All right, this matter will stand submitted. The bank counsel for the arguments. This table will stand in recess for 11:30.
Thank you very much, Ron.